This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Cook's Corner. We all could use a little help in the kitchen, so pick up some useful tips, tricks, and hints, as well as some tasty recipes from leading cooking magazines that will make your next meal a huge success. All on Cook's Corner, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Cook's Corner, and I'm your reader, Marcy, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Cooking at Home, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Recipes and Love My Microwave, by David Chang and Priya Krishna. Copyright 2021 by David Chang. And Eating Well on a Budget, 140 Delicious, Healthy, Affordable Recipes. Copyright 2010 by Eating Well, Inc. And now I'll begin with Cooking at Home, How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Recipes and Love My Microwave, by David Chang and Priya Krishna. Copyright 2021 by David Chang. This article is entitled, The Single Most Important Thing to Learn, How to Season. Good food begins and ends with seasoning, and I'm not just talking about salt. Proper seasoning is about balance, and balance is the key to food that will always taste great. More important than any singular cooking technique is finding the intuition within yourself to know what is too much seasoning and what is too little. Here's an exercise for you. Think of your favorite savory packaged snack, the kind that you get out of a vending machine. Now identify the key flavors in it. Do you love barbecue chips? Then you like sweet and tangy flavors. Flaming Hot Cheetos? You like deeply savory and spicy flavors. Do you like sour cream and onion Pringles? You prefer bold, tangy, salty, and a little sweet. Shrimp chips? You like briny and sweet. So you've established a kind of flavor profile you gravitate toward. Now let's check your salt tolerance. Make any simple broth with no salt, just water and a chicken carcass, or water and vegetable ends. Put the broth in 10 different cups, arranging them in a line, and then add incrementally larger amounts of salt in each. Taste all of them and decide which one allows you to really taste the flavor of the broth without tasting the salt. That's your sweet spot. Is it one of the first cups? Then you have a low salt tolerance. Is it one of the last ones? You like a lot of salt. When you're making any dish, what you are seeking is balance. Think of any great dish in the world. Pizza, vada pav, pho. They are all studies in contrasting flavors and textures that unite to create something harmonious. You can have a predominant flavor in a dish, but everything else needs to support it, like backup singers. When you are making anything, whether it is a braise or a vinaigrette or a sauce, understanding the role that each ingredient plays is essential to proper seasoning. Let's use pizza as an example. The tomato sauce brings tanginess and sweetness, which lightens the heaviness of the cheese. The mozzarella adds richness and creaminess, which rounds out the sharpness of the sauce. The crust provides the chew and a neutral flavor base that the toppings can play off of. Everything does something to counteract or complement everything else. You can use this logic to reverse engineer a great dish. Say I'm making a braise. First, I like to make a flavorful liquid to cook everything in. When I'm initially building flavor, salt is the last thing I'm adding. I start with my other ingredients. Here's a combination I love, kimchi, fish sauce, and gochugaru. The kimchi is bringing acid and salt. The fish sauce has salt and umami. The gochugaru has tanginess and heat. What do I want more of? What do I want less of? Maybe I'm feeling like I want the primary flavor to be the kimchi, so I add a large handful of that to a pot of stock or broth or water, and I taste. That's acidic and salty. I want to balance that out with fish sauce, which is deeply savory, but it also has a lot of salt, so I don't want to add too much. Now to the gochugaru. I don't want to blow your head off with spice, so I just add a pinch. I taste again and add more or less of each until I like it. At this point, I'm probably tasting a good amount of sodium in the liquid, so I only have to add a little bit of salt. Then, with acid, salt, and heat covered, I think about sugar. A lot of really crave-worthy dishes like spaghetti with tomato sauce or barbecue have sweet notes in them. Sugar softens and rounds out a dish. There are all kinds of sweeteners. Some, like honey and maple syrup, have more distinctive flavors, while others, like agave syrup and granulated sugar, are more neutral. I turn to agave syrup a lot because it doesn't require dissolving, so it can be easily mixed into soups, stews, and vinaigrettes, and it doesn't have too strong a flavor. Okay, so I'm happy with the balance I've achieved in my broth. I add some vegetables and start cooking them. But maybe after boiling the braise for a while, I decide to add some chopped pork belly. I let the pork belly cook through and taste again. The dish might need more salt, more acid, more sweetener. Every time you add a new component, it's up to you to make a judgment call as to how to restore balance. You just keep cooking, tasting, and adjusting the seasoning until it's delicious and you're done. What's important to note about this lesson is that everyone's palates are different. When working on this book, I realized that Dave and I have drastically dissimilar palates. He loves rich, meaty, savory flavors. I find myself adding chilies and lime juice to almost every dish because my palate flavors brightness and spice. Dave grew up on sudubu, jjigae, and gomtang. I grew up on dal chawal, sabzi, and kamchumber. As you taste different dishes, either while cooking or at a restaurant, it's a great exercise to ask yourself what you like and don't like about it. Do you find yourself reaching for chili flakes or salt? Do you find a lot of dishes too sweet? The same goes for texture. In a soup, do you like your veggies softened or with a little bite? Do you like your meat to have some chew or for it to be fully disintegrated? All of these things are shaped by your upbringing and surroundings. They tell you a lot about your taste preferences and allow you to construct dishes you like as you develop a vocabulary for articulating your preferences. With time, you'll develop your own favorite ways of cooking your preferred ingredients. The more you eat this way, really taking a moment to think about the flavors of each bite, the more you will gain a greater appreciation for all kinds of foods. Which is why I want to stress again that tastes change. When I moved to New York, I'd only eaten meat and seafood a handful of times. I hadn't tried a host of cuisines. Suddenly, working for a food magazine, I was trying ribeyes, oysters, larb, and galbi jim for the first time. My taste shifted to appreciate briny, beefy, fishy, saucy flavors. When I lived in France and came back to the United States, I noticed that I found the food to be too sweet. When I lived in the Philippines and then came back, I thought the food wasn't sweet enough. By the same token, Dave always talks about how, since he moved to Los Angeles, he has moved away from rich, meaty preparations. He's using tons of citrus, which he never did in New York. He's making mostly vegetarian food. Frankly, he has become an LA cliché. He had kidney stones, which means he has to follow a low-sodium diet, so now, after enough time, he has readjusted his palate to enjoy foods with less salt. Meanwhile, my Dal Chawal-loving self has started craving braised oxtails and gochujang on the regular. It's as if Dave and I have done some kind of Freaky Friday switch. But it's also a cool illustration on how our tastes shift to accommodate our life. The next article I'm going to read is The FAQs on Food Safety by Jacques Overdiep III. If we're going to be talking about how to cook in your home for the next few hundred pages, I have to say this outright. One of the biggest issues I see in other people's homes is an unsanitary kitchen situation. People aren't properly cleaning their surfaces. They're not washing their hands enough. They're keeping leftovers around for way too long. There are so many ways to get sick from food. Maybe we're more attuned to this all because we get fined for it in our restaurants, but it felt useful to have a bit of a guide to food safety in this cookbook. But rather than just paste in the rules from our local sanitation department, we wanted it to be explained in normal language. We were lucky to find Jacques Overdiep III, who works in the packaged food industry and has an encyclopedic understanding of food safety, plus a genuine passion for helping people not accidentally ingest bacteria while defrosting a chicken. We were charmed by his humor and willingness to call Dave out on the safety of his own techniques. Maybe you're surprised to see a guide to food safety in a cookbook. You'd be less surprised if you knew that 1 in 6 Americans get sick from foodborne illness each year. Spending 24 hours in a bathroom is far from pleasant, but that is getting off easy. Children and the elderly are often the ones who can end up seriously ill from mishandling of food in the kitchen. If this is scaring you, it should. Think of me as the smoky bear for foodborne illness. Only you can prevent yourself and others from getting sick from your own cooking. This guide will give you a good sense of how. How long can you hold on to food? What does the sell-by date really mean? A sell-by date, and similarly a best-by date, speaks more to the quality of a food than the safety. Shelf-stable items like canned meats and soups can often be consumed even a year or two after the best-by date, as long as they stay unopened and do not give off any unpleasant odors. Let's just say you'll know when you sniff. If you don't notice a bad smell when you open the can, you are fine. Many refrigerated foods like milk, eggs, unopened sauces, and juices will last up to a week or so past the best-by date. Once opened, most foods and leftovers are fine to eat within 5 days, though this is highly variable depending on the food. A radish could stay in your fridge for 2 weeks. Raw meats probably a few days. Beyond that, foods readily begin to grow nasty-smelling bacteria, and the additional handling, transferring containers, touching the food, and even opening the lid, can risk the induction and growth of dangerous bacteria. Are the guidelines the same for meat? Yes. If you're starting with fresh meat, you can let it go 3 to 4 days past the sell-by date refrigerated. If you plan on freezing meat, make sure to follow the freeze-by date on the package. But just like milk, you'll know when meat is bad. The rotting smell is hard to miss. All this said, bacteria that make you sick often do not have any smell or taste. This advice is for quality purposes only. From a safety perspective, proper cooking, handling, and cooling will help reduce your risk of foodborne illnesses. More on that below. And a side note, the on-sale meat that has 2 days until the sell-by date and is brownish in the package, buy it. The brown hue does not necessarily mean it's been mishandled or is dangerous. If you are going to freeze it or cook it using the guidelines I mentioned above, you probably won't notice a difference. Feel free to send your savings my way. How do I properly keep utensils and surfaces like counters and cutting boards clean, especially after raw meat has touched them? Scrub them with hot, soapy water, rinse clean, and spray all over with a sanitizer. 1 tablespoon bleach to 1 gallon water is a good solution. If you don't want to make your own sanitizer, you can buy it at the store. Look for something that contains ammonium compounds like Mr. Clean or chlorine compounds, bleach, in it. The label should mention that it can be used on cutting boards or counters. If you can, separate your cutting boards by use to minimize cross-contamination, having one for raw meats and one for produce. Avoid using wooden cutting boards for meat, as they are harder to clean and sanitize because they are porous, and pores in wood can trap bacteria that may not get properly cleaned. Discard all cutting boards with significant scarring, as those scars can harbor dangerous bacteria and are very difficult to clean. Let cutting boards and utensils air dry, as using a towel on improperly cleaned surfaces can spread bacteria from one to another. The easiest way to clean any of this stuff, except for wood, is in a dishwasher. Wood can split and crack in the dishwasher, but plastic and metal utensils will thrive in high sanitizing and drying temperatures. How can I tell if meat is fully cooked? Some common indicators of doneness you might see in your average cookbook are cook until juices run clear, or until the inside is no longer pink. Those juices and insides being mentioned are proteins that change color and texture when heat is applied. But there are a lot of factors that can influence the hue of the meat and its juices, like the age of the animal, the type of cut, and even in some cases, how the animal was cared for. Relying on the color of juices when cooking meat is like looking out of your bedroom window, seeing the sun, and assuming it's a shorts and t-shirt kind of day. The only foolproof way to know whether meat is fully and safely cooked is by using a thermometer. Here is a cheat sheet of minimum internal cooking temperatures taken at the middle or thickest part of the food for it to be considered safe. 160 degrees Fahrenheit is for egg dishes and ground meats, not poultry. 165 degrees Fahrenheit for poultry. 145 degrees Fahrenheit for fish. 145 degrees Fahrenheit and then rest for 3 minutes for pork, beef, veal, and lamb. And 165 degrees Fahrenheit for leftovers. A few notes on these temperatures. Ground meats must be handled and prepared more carefully than whole cuts of meat. We can eat steaks rare because we are still cooking the surface of the meat enough to kill the bacteria present. When meats are ground or tenderized, the raw outside of the meat contaminates the inside and requires a more thorough cooking process to kill that bacteria. That's why ground or cube meat should technically be cooked to a minimum internal temperature of 160 degrees, while steaks only need to be heated to 145 degrees Fahrenheit in the guidelines. That said, a medium rare steak or burger is 125 degrees to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, well below the guidelines, so know that you are accepting some level of risk. Chicken and turkey tend to have higher rates of bacteria that can make you sick, which is why the recommendation is to cook all poultry to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, whether it is whole or ground. When heating leftovers, always get the temperature up to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, whether it is a plate of spaghetti or an entire casserole. This will ensure that any bacteria that were introduced during the cooling or transferring of the food are cooked out. Can I stick hot food into the fridge immediately after it's been cooked? It seems straightforward to just throw food in the fridge right after it is served, or if you're meal prepping, right after it's cooked, but it isn't necessarily that simple from a safety perspective. When you put something hot, food, into something cold, refrigerator, the hot things cool down and the cold things heats up. So if you want to have a large quantity of hot food, it could heat your fridge up and cause everything in it to get too warm. And a warm fridge can't cool your hot food down as quickly. At the same time, if you don't cool your food from 140 degrees to 40 degrees Fahrenheit within 6 hours, you risk dangerous bacteria growing in your food and making you sick. This isn't a huge deal if you have a couple of cups of hot soup, but to cool food down faster, put large batches into smaller containers or cut the food into smaller pieces. You can also just let the food cool at room temperature before refrigerating, but for no longer than 2 hours. Any longer than that before refrigeration could also risk bacterial growth. Speaking of fridges, any tips on storing raw meat in the fridge? Do not store any raw meat above ready-to-serve food, even if it is sealed. Juices from the meats can fall onto the cooked food and contaminate it, yet another reason to reheat leftovers to 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Should I be washing all my produce? And what about washing meat? I wash, rinse, and dry produce, including bagged produce, to remove physical contaminants like dirt and insects, even though I can't scrub off bacteria. Fortunately, sort of, with all the recent illness outbreaks associated with lettuce, fruit, and vegetable processors are taking care to ensure a safe product, free of harmful bacteria. Do not use bleach or other cleaners on produce, as these can harm you and, quite frankly, don't taste very good. That being said, do not wash meat. We cook our food to kill the dangerous bacteria on meat, and rinsing the meat will spread these bacteria on your sink, your counter, and your clean dishes on the drying rack. Don't do it. How do I safely thaw meat? There are a few safe methods for thawing food, and unfortunately, none of them are leaving it on the counter. The safest way is to place meat in the refrigerator on the bottom shelf to thaw overnight or for a few nights if it's a large cut or a whole bird. Other options are the microwave defrost function, though this can begin to cook the meat, or running cool water over the meat while it's still in its packaging. From a safety perspective, you can refreeze meats that were thawed in the refrigerator but not in the sink or the microwave. The risk of bacterial growth during the thawing process outside of the refrigerator is too high because you have no control over the surface temperature of those thawed meats. That said, refrozen meats tend to be tougher and drier after each freezing cycle. And now I'll be reading from Eating Well on a Budget, 140 Delicious, Healthy, Affordable Recipes by Jesse Price and the Eating Well Test Kitchen. Copyright 2010, Eating Well, Inc. This recipe is for stuffed tomatoes with golden crumb topping. This comforting dish is a perfect way to take advantage of low-cost ground meat and those big hothouse tomatoes that aren't quite good enough for salad, but will intensify in flavor and sweetness in the oven. For vegetarians, omit the beef or turkey and add beans instead. Serve with a mixed green salad with garden-fresh vegetables. Your shopping list for this recipe is as follows. 4 ounces of 90% lean ground beef or 93% lean ground turkey, cooked brown rice, 4 large ripe but firm tomatoes, kosher salt, freshly ground pepper, petite green peas, red onion, Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, flat leaf parsley, whole wheat breadcrumbs, extra virgin olive oil, and one small clove of garlic. For your ingredients, you will need 4 ounces of 90% lean ground beef or 93% lean ground turkey, 1 cup of cooked brown rice, 4 large ripe but firm tomatoes, about 8 ounces each, 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt divided, freshly ground pepper to taste, 1/2 cup of petite green peas, cooked if fresh or just thawed if frozen, 1/4 cup of minced red onion, 1/2 cup grated Parmigiano Reggiano cheese divided, 1 tablespoon minced flat leaf parsley, 1 cup fresh whole wheat breadcrumbs, 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, and 1 small clove of garlic minced. Step 1. Preheat oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Coat an 8-inch square baking dish with cooking spray. Step 2. Cook ground beef or turkey in a small skillet over medium-high heat, crumbling with a spoon until brown and cooked through, 1 to 2 minutes. Transfer to a large bowl. Stir in rice. Step 3. Slice enough off the top of each tomato to remove the core, 1/2 to 1 inch. Scoop out the tomato pulp using a teaspoon or melon baller. Finally, chop 1/2 cup of the pulp and add to the bowl with the meat and rice. Reserve the remaining pulp for another use if desired. Save the scooped out tomato pulp to use in fresh tomato soup or pasta sauce. It will keep in the refrigerator for up to 3 days or in the freezer for up to 6 months. Season the inside of the tomatoes with 1/4 teaspoon of salt and pepper. Step 4. Add peas, onion, 1/4 cup of cheese, parsley, the remaining 1/4 teaspoon of salt and pepper to the meat mixture. Stir to combine. Divide the mixture evenly among the tomatoes and place the tomatoes in the prepared baking dish. Combine the remaining 1/4 cup of cheese, breadcrumbs, oil, and garlic in a small bowl. Sprinkle the mixture on top of the tomatoes. Step 5. Bake the tomatoes until crumbs are golden and the tomatoes are soft, 25 to 30 minutes. Serve immediately. This next recipe is for Hungarian beef goulash. This hearty goulash is a streamlined, slow cooker version of the traditional Hungarian recipe. Instead of the time-consuming process of browning the beef, the chunks are coated in a spice crust to give a rich mahogany hue. Serve over whole wheat egg noodles, or for something different, try prepared potato gnocchi or spätzle. Your shopping list for this recipe is as follows. 2 pounds beef stew meat, such as chuck, caraway seeds, sweet or hot paprika, or a mixture of the two, preferably Hungarian, salt, freshly ground pepper, 1 large or 2 medium onions, 1 small red pepper, 1 14-ounce can of diced tomatoes, 1 14-ounce can reduced sodium beef broth, Worcestershire sauce, 3 cloves of garlic, bay leaves, cornstarch, and chopped fresh parsley. For the ingredients, you will need 2 pounds of beef stew meat, such as chuck, trimmed and cubed, 2 teaspoons of caraway seeds, 1 1/2 to 2 tablespoons sweet or hot paprika, or a mixture of the two, preferably Hungarian, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, freshly ground pepper to taste, 1 large or 2 medium onions, chopped, 1 small red bell pepper, chopped, 1 14-ounce can of diced tomatoes, 1 14-ounce can of reduced sodium beef broth, 1 teaspoon of Worcestershire sauce, 3 cloves of garlic minced, 2 bay leaves, 1 tablespoon cornstarch mixed with 2 tablespoons of water, and 2 tablespoons chopped fresh parsley. Step 1. Place beef in a 4-quart or larger slow cooker. Crush caraway seeds with the bottom of a saucepan. Transfer to a small bowl and stir in paprika, salt, and pepper. Sprinkle the beef with the spice mixture and toss to coat well. Top with onion and bell pepper. Step 2. Combine tomatoes, broth, Worcestershire sauce, and garlic in a medium saucepan. Bring to a simmer. Pour over the beef and vegetables. Place bay leaves on top. Cover and cook until the beef is very tender, 4 to 4.5 hours on high or 7 to 7.5 hours on low. Step 3. Discard the bay leaves. Skim or blot any visible fat from the surface of the stew. Add the cornstarch mixture to the stew. Cover and cook on high, stirring 2 or 3 times until slightly thickened or 10 to 15 minutes. Serve sprinkled with parsley. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Marcy with Cook's Corner. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.